Good morning. My name is John Case, and welcome to the Talking Socialism Show from here, May 28th, 2020, plague year number one. And today we're going to be talking about the recent economic reports of and warnings of a depression coming from Nobel Prize winners Paul Krugman and Joseph Stiglitz, as well as leading economist Larry Summers, Nouriel Roubini, and an interesting socialist economist from the New School, Richard Wolff, also talking about the kinds of recovery from a depression that may be required. Joining us this morning, Carl Davidson, a longtime leader on left-wing socialist organizations, including the Committees of Correspondence for Democracy and Socialism, and also a leader of SDS in the old days, and former editor, writer of the Guardian newspaper in the United States, along with Randy Shannon and Tina Shannon, both very active in Beaver County, Pennsylvania, and in Progressive Democrats of America, also formerly with the Committees of Correspondence and a lot of other outfits. Anyway, longtime activist, as also, of course, our stars of our show here, the Mikey, Mike Diesel Cucarini, and J.B. Christensen, our pals here from the Eastern Panhandle, but longtime radio collaborators here in West Virginia. And so let's go. Here we go. But at the moment, yes, now we are. Yes, now we are recording. But that's just so that I, you know, I don't forget, and I can edit out, you know, stuff before the show. That's
not a hard. Good morning, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the ships at sea, friends in the air, and vehicles on the ground. We are coming to you from EnlightenRadio.com. We are coming to you on Talking Socialism. We have your host and original Dusty Putter philosopher, Mr. John Case, and his sidekick, who's always here with Talking Socialism, J.B. Christensen, and me, the loudmouth guy, Mike. All right, welcome.
I'm going to call you, start calling you the Mikey.
The Mikey.
The Mighty Mikey.
Yeah.
I might do that, you know.
That was the old cereal commercial, and my life was never the same after that. It was, hey, Mikey hates it. He won't eat anything.
Anyway,
look, hey, Mikey, he likes it. It's the same. And then they just did another one with a female Mikey. So.
Say something for a minute. Hold on 1 second. I got Carol wants something. Hold on a second here.
Hey, JB.
Hey, man. How you doing, brother?
I'm good, man. I've been doing some outside work, just down Fran's house and up here, just doing gardening and doing some landscaping, and that's about it. I just did the prep for our little redneck pool, so I'm pretty pleased about that.
All right,
and, John, we have Tina Shannon joining us.
Yes,
it looks like.
I know. Let me get. Okay.
Very good.
I had to answer some important questions about the puppy from my wife. You know.
Well, they are important if it's about Lukey. So there you go.
Lukey's boat is painted green, prettiest boat you've ever seen.
Nice. You know.
The other line is every is a fine four cutty, every hole is chunked with putty.
Nice.
The great big sea. Great. Good morning, Carl Davidson, and good morning, Tina Shannon, and Carl, you've been on before, so I'll introduce our crazy friends here from the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia. We got Mike Diesel, who sometimes appears as either Trump or Bernie Sanders. He's a professional comedian, and you know.
I know some people who are for both.
Yeah. And one of the best, comedians I've ever heard. Because I haven't been going to all the comedy clubs over years, but.
Well, the comics aren't going to the comedy clubs now, John.
No, nobody's going to the comedy clubs now. Right, and Tina Shannon, who I just basically know from Facebook and the Committees of Correspondence, also too. How you doing, Tina? Good morning.
I'm good. Okay. I feel as well as can be expected.
Is Randy going to get on here too, or okay?
He's breakfast and coffee early so he could so we can get on.
Oh, well, that's good. That's good. Okay. And J.B. Christensen in my upper left, I guess, on my screen, who's we partnered together on the Labor Beat radio program for nearly a decade before we got thrown off. And anyway.
And whose fault was that? Oh, I'm sorry. That's right. I should shut up because I came along. I came along, and then 6 months later, you guys were removed.
No, it was a couple of years. It was a couple of years, you know.
You were there a long time, Mike.
I was. About 3 years.
That's iced coffee, guys. It's not Guinness.
That's right.
Well, trust but verify, as President Reagan once said. You know, but, anyway, there's Randy. Good morning, Randy. Randy Shannon, also a friend from the Committees of Correspondence, and he's also in Pittsburgh. These guys are very active, by the way, in Progressive Democrats of America. I think they can tell you that they got somebody elected at some point down there, which is always good.
Don, we're not in Pittsburgh.
Right, we're.
Let's clear that up right now.
Oh, okay.
We're in
Beaver County, okay. Which is part of the Rust Belt.
That's right.
Steel Valley.
Yeah, he sound like he's from Pittsburgh there. Yeah. You know, down there with the Iron City beer. Didn't sound like that.
Although we like it. Pittsburgh is the Paris of Appalachia.
That's right.
I grew up in the northern panhandle region of West Virginia. I lived right over the border in Pennsylvania.
Did
all our shopping in West Virginia. And
pretty close to Wheeling, right?
But yeah. It was back when the drinking age was 18.
Right.
Nice.
We spent a lot of our time.
Right.
All of us Pennsylvania hoopies.
Right.
Do they call them hoopies? Do you use hoopies in West Virginia? That's what we call theirs.
I haven't called them that yet.
That's the best policy, John.
I was a greaser and a hoopie who made me run over the line to West Virginia in order to...
A greaser.
Well, I had a girlfriend once, and her mother was from Wheeling, and she was one of the founders of the United Electrical Workers. Her memory of Wheeling was going door to door to raise money to bury her father in the Depression. But she got a mine worker scholarship to college. First person in that family ever to go anywhere near a college, okay?
And on a mine worker scholarship.
Right. And of course afterwards she got a great job working for John L. Lewis and ended up organizing the first Sylvania plant in Emporia, Pennsylvania. And she did it by pretending to be a nurse. Actually, she did have nursing training. She wasn't a fraud. But, you know, back then, you know, like her father had been a doctor without a medical degree. Okay, kind of thing. Which used to be, you know, if you got trained in the Army as a medical corps or something like that, and you showed up in the hills of West Virginia, you know, in the 19th century, come on, you know. So she set up a nursing thing, and that's how she built union committees in the Emporia plant, which was 80% women, okay? And anyway, wow. So I attribute that to her to Wheeling, West Virginia.
That's like that I'm a brain surgeon. Well, I'm not licensed.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, today,
too much schooling.
let me introduce today's agenda here a little bit, because all of us, I'm sure, have been reading over the past 2 weeks, and I see that Randy posted one of them, and actually JB posted one of them too. But Richard Wolff is saying about the cruelty of unemployment. The Nouriel Roubini, who predicted the last recession, is probably the most pessimistic in terms of saying it's going to take a decade to get out of this. Well, a decade's like you can have two world wars in a decade, okay? And then we have Larry Summers' interview with Richard Levin at Yale University, which is a pretty deep and detailed thing. And also Joe Stieglitz was interviewed, I think, on Bloomberg at length, another Nobel Prize winner. And they are, and then yesterday, I think Noah Smith, who's one of the top kind of middle of the road economists for Bloomberg, interviewed Paul Krugman at length. And while there's not an exact consensus, it's pretty clear from everybody that the warnings of a something equal to, greater than, or nearly as same as the Great Depression are either a likely, possible, but in all cases, serious outcome here of what we're headed into. And so, you know, that's, I remember Jim Mattless in his final speech to the UE before he retired, well, actually he died on the road, founder of the UE. And I remember in 1976, one of his last speeches when he was hearing about how the business roundtable and the leaders of General Electric and, you know, the top people in the Trilateral Commission were, you know, making speeches about how, well, we're going to have to accumulate so much money to reproduce the system that it's not going to be possible to live with the New Deal or anything that came out of it. And I remember Mattless, you know, telling the assembled convention people there, and I think it was in Pittsburgh. I think the convention was in Pittsburgh that year, that that's where we came in. That's where we came in his Romanian accent. And that, you know, the multitudes would eventually respond. So I'm interested in all your all's points of view on this. And particularly, it looks to me like a socialist movement, maybe of a new kind, but certainly history is important, but we're, you know, we can't be looking in the rearview mirror all the time either. It's a tremendous opportunity and a danger. It's pretty clear to me from Minneapolis that that's the Trump program about how to deal with a Great Depression, you know, which is a turn on all the racism, you know, get the murderous cops to let loose and do their thing.
Oh, he even tweeted when the, you know, the, he tweeted a phrase from a police sheriff from years ago that he said, when the looting starts, the shooting starts.
So 10 years of what? If you listen to Nouriel Roubini, for example, 10 years of Minneapolis, you know, 10 years of what? And anyway, I'm going to shut up and just raise your hand if you want to speak. So we try not to talk over each other too much. One of the great things about YouTube, of course, is that if people watch the YouTube thing, they can tell the difference between who's speaking. But on the radio part, too many voices gets a little confusing sometimes for people. Who wants to go first? How about Carl? Let's get Carl. He's a celebrity.
Kind of. But I was interesting.
Welcome, just Carl.
Just before I came on, I was reading an article in Foreign Affairs. It's called The Age of Magic Money. And they were trying to evaluate, you know, what was the significance of all this vast expansion of the money supply through selling bonds and whatever. And you know, whether it was risky business or not. It was interesting that they did this whole long article without once mentioning, you know, modern monetary theory and the people behind it. But they've all been, they're all shame-faced converts these days because they have a tremendous need. And they realize if they don't do something, there's going to be a disaster. I think the question for us is, you know, I always put a caveat with modern monetary theory. I think it, you know, it's fine, but it needs to go for productive investment, and that way you get it back, and you get it back many times over. It's like Roosevelt used modern monetary theory to create the Hoover Dam, and it's paid for itself 10 times over since he did it. And so anyway, you know, one thing we know for certain, we're going to have huge numbers of unemployment, even if they open up the economy to a certain degree. People, that doesn't mean customers are going to flood the stores. People are going to be very nervous about going back. So there's going to be large-scale unemployment for the years ahead. So there's two ways to deal with it. One is just, you know, give people money, which I don't necessarily have anything against. But I think Richard Wolff, who's a Marxist economist, came out with an interesting alternative. He said that socialists should be advocating. He said we should not be arguing so much for unemployment benefits as for re-employment programs. In other words, instead of paying people money while they're not doing anything, let's put people to work with a government as the employer and of last resort, so to speak, and let's do it with the Green New Deal and other projects that return, that are the investments that return well. And it's time for us to start advocating for mass re-employment program to make this a three-way fight instead of just a two-way fight between those who don't want to give us anything to punish us to get back to work and those who, you know, want to extend the current. So let's put a third alternative on the table. Fight for re-employment programs in the form of a Green New Deal.
Who's next?
I could not agree with you more, Carl. When I saw that that piece with Richard Wolff on, I think it was called Free Speech TV, That's about all I watch anymore because there's, you know, it's everything that I believe in is pretty much on there. Racial equality, economic equality, just, you know, bringing the poor up so that they can live a decent life and have a place to go and have a roof over their head.
And they tell the truth about the extraction industry too, Jamie.
Yeah, they from the beginning, you know, they've always been on the forefront. But Richard Wolff brings up a great point there, and I don't think anybody could really argue against that, because the way he puts it, he so eloquently describes how it would work that there, I don't see anybody coming up with an alternate plan. I mean, we have no plan. That's the real part of it. There is no plan. What we would do with Richard Wolff's proposal is have a plan for the first time and allow for the Green New Deal to be implemented. I agree with you 100% there, Carl. And I couldn't believe what I was watching when I watched it, because it was so logical and you know, it just makes so much sense and would really put our country back in a good footing, I think.
I met him in Berlin, where we both given a talk for the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, and I was given a talk on Mondragon and the nature of the co-ops there. And so he wanted to go visit him. So I hooked him up with the right people so that, you know, the head of their people in Mondragon, so he could go visit. And it had a big impression on him. So he argues not only that we have this re-employment program, he wants one dimension of it. If we can't find, you know, private employers to take up building the Green New Deal, that we shape a lot of them as worker cooperatives at the same time. And there's lots of, you know, but that's part of Bernie's platform. And we have a national community bank that was used as, you know, was created a long time ago. And it's only been used to sort of cash the checks for the rural cooperatives. But with a few tweaks, we could use that as a national cooperative bank to help build some worker cooperatives, too, as part of the Green New Deal. So not only is it sensible in an immediate sense, he also, within it, he poses some radical structural reforms that point to a new order.
Anybody else?
I just had a follow-up comment. Community bank, Carl, can that also be linked to, I know I've read this, that there's some interest in linking that to the state of Colorado and how much money and growth is just in processing and growing marijuana and hemp. I mean, I'm just saying that there's no bank that, you know, they have to do everything cash wise. So there, you know, there's a lot, there's actually some of these businesses, there's actually some really nasty stuff going on where they're being robbed.
And they have to carry around their bill payments.
You know, and yeah. I mean, I'm just wondering if that community bank would be willing to. That might be an interesting prospect.
Great example is obviously the Bank of North Dakota, which was won by the populace back around the turn of the century. It was one of the most stable banks during the 2008 crisis. It weathered it without any problems.
Yeah.
And it's a socialist idea, basically, that We want to make public, you know, finance, a section of finance capital, and turn it into assets that the working class can use, or the public can use. So I think that not only can you advocate for state banks in every state, any place that has a revenue stream, instead of putting your revenue stream into private banks, you put it into a public bank, in which case, and then the public bank can put it to a much better use than the private banks do. And you can also do it on the less, you can do it, say, for a metropolitan area, say the greater Pittsburgh metropolitan area could set up a state bank. I mean, you know, a public bank for that region. And so it's an idea whose time has come.
I think it arose originally as part of the fight against foreclosures among the farmers in North Dakota. It's by the way, the guy that runs that bank right now, he had an interesting editorial along these lines, you know, actually 3 or 4 weeks ago. But someone asked about who could oppose it. Well, you know, the WPA and CCC programs, Conservation Corps, and a number of other Roosevelt programs in the 1930s were inspired by a section of John Maynard Keynes that talked about this, okay, about the kind of public works that you could have. I mean, Keynes actually was more agnostic about it. He ended up saying it'd be okay if people just went out and dig holes and filled them back up again. It would have the stimulative effect on the economy, and you know, people would be able to buy things, okay? It would be better than doing nothing. That was Keynes' point, okay?
Yeah, but John, wouldn't you agree that we have this huge infrastructure deficit going on?
That was the idea in the 30s with the WPA. Yeah. But who was one of the principal critics of the program was the American Federation of Labor.
And yeah, they have to get on board.
They had a reason. They had a reason why they were opposed, okay? And their reason was is that if you have a government of last resort employment program, unless it's paying less than the private sector for comparable work, okay, then it can be, the arguments of economists is it will be inflationary, all right? And in addition to that, okay, remember a lot of the work that was going to be done in terms of public works in those times was also work that would fall under classifications covered by the American Federation of Labor, right? So from the AFL took the point of view that this was going to end up cutting rates for their trades, okay? And remember, AFL trades were, the economy of that was local market power, okay? That's how it worked. You had local market power, you could protect your wages. You didn't have local market power, you couldn't. And so there was a reason for it, but yes, they were wrong. Well, what were they? Why? Because raising the floor with the employer of last resort program, whatever it is, you know, is the surest immediate way to raise all incomes. And actually, it wouldn't have ended up, in places where it's worked. Now, keep in mind, also, one of the ways that Denmark's labor movement sort of went in this direction and is that who killed the opposition of some sort of narrow trade kind of thinking, right, was why not make the labor movement responsible, you know, for the assignment and retraining of jobs in this employer of last resort program. And that's also how they ended up accommodating themselves to trade. And they still have, like, their economy is 70% trade, and they have 90% union density, okay? You know, so you give the labor movement, take it out of this thing, oh, well, you only exist if you have a firm-level contract with some particular plant or some giant corporation, right? Well, how much market power do you have there? I mean, not much, right? Instead, make them part of the public sector, in a sense, right? So anyway, that debate about the impact on wages of the employer of last resort program is a non-trivial issue among the economists. So it means you have to be creative about it, really, okay? But on the other hand, you know, China, you know, you can look at it two different ways, I think. You can look at it from a standpoint of, like, social democracy, right, in which, you know, we fight an uphill battle all the time to try and manage the extreme defects of corporate rule or corporate investment or corporate practices or biases. And, you know, we end up on the defensive most of the time. Or you can, you know, if history smashes everything that we've known, regardless of anyone's plans to do so, you might have to take the Chinese approach or something similar, you know, where the state gets the commanding heights of the economy, and then allows capitalism, in effect, to operate in those areas where it's useful.
Talk to Randy. He's our point man on the Belt and Road. And Tina, she knows about how all this stuff applies and what we
don't. UBI.
Randy and Tina, then, so, weigh in on this.
Well, you know, I think if we start talking about it, one of the things I like about Richard Wolff is I think his messaging is completely spot on, and I can send people directly into his messaging without having to translate it. I'm an organizer. Like I pay attention to what all you guys are saying and I learn about it, but my main thing I have to do is figure out what people on the ground here with me are ready and willing to hear. So I think that talking about a jobs program is something that we should be ready to do and we're going to have to do, but I think we're getting ahead of ourselves, because where I live, nobody wants to go back to work. Like there are two camps. We have a far right state legislator who has found a little niche, I believe, in the alt-right, and he is organizing the back to work rallies in Harrisburg. And then the people that I'm moving amongst and organizing and who are ready to organize, who are ready to be organized as never before, are the people who are fighting with him and saying, you're all a bunch of freaking idiots. Like, we don't want to go back to work. So it's not time for me yet to move the message of a jobs program into the people, because that would just play into what right now is the organized rights message of we got to go back to work. So I think that we should, and plus people don't feel like the government can do anything right now. That's another problem, is that we have to get people to the point where they feel like they could actually win something. I started organizing yesterday on the Emergency Health Care Act, and over the week, the people that I was trying to get interested in it immediately said yes. And the interesting thing is that I think the trillions going into the corporations are changing the mindset about MMT almost immediately. Like, I think we've had a big transformation, because in the meeting that I organized last night, I was, of course, prepared to answer the question of how are you going to pay for it? And the question did not come up. Like, for the first time ever, there was no one that said, well, wait a minute, isn't that going to be expensive? Nobody said that. So I think that we should be, if we want to get a Democrat elected in November, what we need to do is we need to have people demanding things from the Democratic Party right now so that they have to move into a more populist position. So that's why, like, I would back up and go for the, you know, the income support before. But you're right. Also, we do need to have a plan of, like, reemployment. And I've been telling people that that's what's coming, and that we should be studying the politics of the New Deal and how the New Deal actually happened, not just like in big terms. But Randy and I just listened to the book about Randy.
Francis Perkins.
Yeah, Francis Perkins, my hero. I want a T-shirt. What would Francis Perkins do? So I think that we need to just step. As leftists, we need to first get people turning toward the government to actually do something, and like how to fight the government. Because people now are just like spinning off in their own little self-support food bank things. People are saying, like, you know, we can't look at them to do anything for us. So,
Randy, you've been quiet.
Well, I think that toward the end of World War II, or just after, the Kellogg Company instituted a six-hour day for its employees. And the labor movement, which was, what, five times as big as the current labor movement, was demanding a six-hour day. And Kellogg had a kind of like a paternalistic attitude toward his employees, who were most, about 90% female. And so instead of laying people off, he just created four shifts. And it had a tremendous social impact because the women started to get involved in politics and community activism, and, you know, they had time. And so President Truman issued a National Security Council, a National Security document, promulgation.
An executive
order? Well, it was something like that. It's one of those national security things. But basically it said that the six-hour day was a threat to national security. This is not a joke.
No, I know.
So, I mean, it is kind of ridiculous. But yeah, it's the six-hour day is a threat to national security, because we have to mobilize the workforce and everything we've got to fight Russia. So that was, and you know, the way they fought it in Kellogg was the guys that worked in Kellogg were like, you know, I can work an 8-hour day. I'm a man. So they actually infiltrated more and more males into the different departments until the 6-hour day was gone. And so, you know, that's something very concrete that does not take the creation of new jobs or digging holes and filling them up. You know, that should, in my opinion, that should be a primary demand of working class movement in the United States and the people who support it, because it also addresses, you know, the question of rationalization of production, you know, where you have less and less people making more and more shit. So, you know, these plans and stuff that have been talked about, I mean, I agree with all of them. You know, I was just thinking, you know, that burning down police stations is a tremendous job creation project. It is.
Yeah.
And it also could be some social disciplining of these racist murderers that, you know, that are in the police department. But I think we have to think of some concrete steps toward an economic program. And, you know, when the labor movement was powerful, it wanted a six-hour day. So now it's not so powerful. You know, there's another issue that we have to deal with. But six-hour day is important. Also, you know, I just want to say that labor unions have been sought out by a lot of employees who are threatened on the job by, you know, their employers' lack of concern about the COVID-19 right. Spread. So, and that's another good reason to bring labor unions into the workplace. But with a workforce that is 90% unorganized, I just kind of like wonder, how are all these wonderful plans going to take place? I mean, they're great ideas, and I agree with all of them. But without organized workers, how's that going to happen? Right. So, you know, Nouriel, Roubini, and those other guys, they could be right. Especially if we don't have a more organized workforce.
Good.
So every time I hear the phrase, we got to build a movement, I cringe. The capitalists build the movements. What we have to, by their outrages, set and tax on us. What we have to do is build organizations. That's what Randy's saying here, that 90% of the working class is unorganized. Our job is to build organizations within the context of fanning the flames of the movements around it. But if we don't build organizations and just build movements, once the tide ebbs, we don't have anything.
Well, history will probably take care of the movement part. We have to take care of the organizing part. But I have an observation on this, on the equipment, because while we're contemplating these plans, I view the Minneapolis incidents as a part of Trump's plan. And I want to recall, you know, the 60s had a, there were several streams of powerful movements that not always aligned, but sometimes were aligned, especially the civil rights and the anti-war movements of the time. But I want you to recall that Nixon had a plan for that too. And it was murder and repression. And I recall in particular in Buffalo where we one day were able to put almost 12,000 people in the streets of Buffalo, which is a big crowd for Buffalo. And the next day, this campus is assaulted with armed tech squad, red squad, wherever they were, with shotguns to shut down a protest that took place at halftime by African-American basketball players who got scholarships to the University of Buffalo, SUNY, but could never transfer to another major. If they wanted to major in, in English or science or something like that, no, I'm sorry, you got to play football to the last day you're here and then goodbye, right? Anyway, so we had and everything within a period of 2 or 3 months, you know, we had 23 grand jury indictments. And any other number of stuff, and we became a movement of defense committees. And of course, so when I see these things happen, like in Minneapolis, I mean, I always got to keep in mind, when you're talking about organizing, you got to keep in mind that the other side has plans too. And they have probably more plans than we have. And so we're going to be talking about an environment. We're talking about an environment in which you're going to have a lot of reasons to get distracted.
John, you have to think about the oranges. You have to think about the oranges.
So, but central worker organizing, for example, I think Randy's right. I mean, I probably, if you'd have talked to me 10 years ago about the six-hour day, I'd probably, well, okay, yeah, well, you know, I'd be like those speeches I used to hear at the Longshore Workers Hall in San Francisco, where the old timers would get up and says, "When the workers sneeze in unison, the temples of Wall Street will be shaking." but now, I mean, in terms of the kind of return to work you're talking about, in a lot of situations, especially service occupations, right? Well, we might, you know, lots of occupations, you might have, and I think we see that essential workers, no one's going to take care of them but themselves. And I think, well, I hope Richard Trumka and all the other unions are headed out to those shops and workplaces right now, because now is a good time to organize them. But I just want to keep in mind that the other side has a plan too.
John, I don't think the other side has a well thought out plan at this point.
No,
I think they are in deep, deep shit.
Yeah.
They don't know what the hell to do. Okay. So the guys are saying, well, let's just grab the money while it's there. They're the only ones that are stepping out.
Yeah, they're playing.
There are a few that are like, well, you know, maybe we should spread some money around. And of course, Nancy Pelosi says, well, not too much, you know, because remember, we got to pay for this somehow. But that's why we're in the situation we're in, because it's just been borrowing money and buying stock. I mean, that's all they've been doing.
I know.
Yeah, I mean, I think also too, their main goal, main objective has been, I mean, through ALEC and all their legislation is a right to work country. They don't want unions. They don't want unions at the federal level. They don't want unions at the state level. They don't want private unions. They don't want unions at all. That's their dream goal, which, forgive me, I find is just complete and absolute bullshit. I can't see us continuing down this road. The situation that's happening right now is people of my generation, I always heard them poo-poo unions. And I heard my dad got in trouble for even mentioning union when he was a cop in Fairfax County. He got promoted, then they bumped him down to motorcycle duty on shift work because they heard he was talking about unions. You know, that's just crap. You know,
and now they don't want to pay taxes either. They want to get rid of taxes and the government.
Right, and people are finding out that they actually are valuable. Their work does mean something. It is important. So, you know, next time around, when some of these, I hear these, you know, flippant comments about how, oh, we don't need to pay them a living wage. Bullshit, you do too. You need to pay them a wage and you need to give them some goddamn benefits.
It doesn't even have to be a union. I mean, I'm just saying workers need to be more organized.
Right.
Organize into whatever the hell you want. But at least if you're getting together, communicating, right. You know this shit's going to come up that's concerning everybody. So,
well, I think consciousness is changing. Like, so I have several little constituencies that I organize amongst. Like, I have my regular working class folks who, like, I have like a core of activists that I've worked with for a long time. Now I have some new young Bernie people. They were always favorable to unions and raised the minimum wage. And then recently, since Trump, there have been in my district, I live in the working class part of my congressional district. I live in a economically depressed small town. There's a string of economically depressed small towns along our river. But then we got also some of the suburbs of Pittsburgh in our new congressional redistricting. So I've got these that just happened like 2 years ago. So I have all these now, these nice white ladies, suburban white ladies, who are outraged by Trump. Like, some of them may have been like Republicanish leaning earlier, but now a lot of those nice white ladies are on board with rate, you know, raise the minimum wage to 15, and you know, I no longer get any pushback about, the only pushback I get in any of my union talk is right here in Beaver County about the unions are very pro fracking and pro, we have a big cracker, that big cracker plant growing up.
No.
So that's the tension here is between the environment and unions. But people, as far as like the working class and essential workers and service workers, this is a chance like never before. And all the essential workers are exhausted because they're being worked like crazy. The small business people are like starting to see or like feeling that split between them and the corporations. The business, you know, Chamber of Commerce used to exploit. Yeah.
Let me just make this comment one more time because it's important to mention this now. Out of the stimulus bill that was passed for businesses, right? The $538 billion, I think somewhere in that range. Of that, I believe we've spent $41 million. $9.7 million of that went to a drilling company that was filing for bankruptcy, and each one of the top executives got million-dollar bonuses. So, you know, I think the more you run into small business people and the more you make them aware of that, the more pissed off they get. And the more they're likely to side with more left-leaning investment in terms of stimulus packages.
I work for a small business, and I got a letter 2 weeks ago that everybody's pay was going to be cut 10%. And so I was like, why the hell don't you apply for that relief, that loan, you know, the government? And they said, you must be out of your freaking mind. Have you seen that bill? Nobody can do that. They said, I even talked to my accounting firm, and they looked into it, and they recommend that nobody who is a small business touch that thing because it's impossible. And then once you actually get approved, they have you by something.
Yeah.
You know, it's
not free money.
Where are the union organizers? I mean, all these people, you're saying,
right.
where are the union organizers?
Hey, we should go for the 4-hour day so that we can.
Plenty
go,
of time.
We'll go for the 4 and then we'll take 6 as a compromise.
Yeah. Always aim high, right? It's like,
you guys.
People don't know how to bargain. Oh my God.
My daughter's a union organizer. She's a very good one. She organized doctors for a while. She knew how to walk into hospitals like she owned a joint.
Man, that's hard to do.
And she never deferred to doctors. She just looked at them straight in the eye. She organized 500 of them down in Texas. Now she's organizing writers for all the big blogs
my God, thank her from my wife.
I mean, for the anyway. National Writers Worker Union? UAW 1998 or something like that.
Right. So anyway, so there's union organizing going on among young people, but sometimes you have to look for it. There's not enough of it, for sure. But before we end the show, I'd like to bring up one thing I just learned this morning. Have you all heard what Boogaloo is? Boogaloo is a term in the far right for, you know, provoking race war. And these are guys who want to start a new civil war.
Yeah. Sort of
John Brown's in reverse, you know.
Right.
And the thing about them is that they've shown up in Minneapolis. And they actually have been sent teams in with their guns and whatnot to get involved in escalating some of the violence in the riots. So when you see a lot of white, if you see some white faces among those crowds, especially any carrying any kind of weapons, they're known for wearing Hawaiian shirts with the body armor underneath them. They're from the far. They might, you know. There's a far right contingent that's gone in there to fan the flames to their advantage. So it's something to keep in mind.
Every one of the people who, when SDS was doing its thing in Buffalo, I mean, I must have had visits from at least 10 people offering me assistance in armed struggle. You know, and. Every one of them. Well, I don't know about every one of them. At least half of them turned out to be, you know, police agents of one kind or another, right, or informants.
Almost nearly all. In fact, we organized a workshop at one of our SES conventions. We organized a workshop on bomb making. So the idea was to draw all of the FBI agents would descend on that workshop, and the rest of them could proceed.
You can get back to work about what you really wanted to do.
Yeah. But I took it all personally. You know, I was one of those in COINTELPRO had certain people targeted for neutralization, and I was one of them.
You were on the list, huh?
Me and a couple other of the national secretaries of SCS.
I know. So yeah, I mean, the terrorist side, you know, will come out. I think though that the CIO was not organized by the AFL, which was the existing labor movement at the time.
Say the least.
And it was organized by mostly, but not all. I mean, I'd say about half socialists and half sort of Christian socialist kind of people, right? I mean, and
some IWW
people. And some IWW people, you know, very, very prominent. Who had been trying to struggle with, can you do industrial unionism? But the committees that formed, the Trade Union Unity League, the Trade Union Educational League, a bunch of others, you know, that were founded and... became the organizing committees, you know, when Flint finally happened, okay, And, you know, the showdown took place, and you forced Roosevelt to side with the workers, not Roosevelt and the governor of Michigan to side with the workers, not the strike breakers. Then, you know, the industrial labor movement was born, or certified, so to speak, at that point.
That was Francis Perkins, John, not FDR.
Right.
Well, that was Francis
Perkins.
Yes, I know.
It was.
But they had to get both Francis and Eleanor had to tell Franklin what he had to do and what he could not do. Okay. So yes, they were his connection to anything on the left anyway. So
I live with labor folks. And I go to the meeting with my labor guys. So I look at labor as I look at any institution of my people, which is something that I got to push. So if we, you know, labor, the labor bureaucracy is not going to organize unless we push them. And, you know, we push them the way we always push them, which is by organizing people that are making demands of them. So, I mean, I guess we just haven't pushed the labor to hire more organizers, which they're going to have to do. So
we must keep evaluating and pushing forward.
Thank you.
Isn't that how we always end?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. That's what I've been saying for 30 years.
Actually, 40.
1% controls everything. We have to stop them.
All right, Bernie. That's a fitting close to our program here. Anyway, anybody else have another? A final word? Not. Okay. Well, that's great. Good discussion. And by the way, I don't know where everything's going in the Zoom world or the stay-at-home world or not yet going back to work world, but, you know, there may be a way in which these kind of sessions could be, you know, more regionalized, right? In other words, there's no reason not to try to get, you know, people that are active involved in these kind of discussions, right? But you can only fit a certain number of people at once on a Zoom thing. I understand they do have the webinar format where you can have a larger meeting, right? I haven't done that yet, but... But
you may want to talk to my wife about that, John. She's been involved in producing some of those webinar things. So if you need to talk to her a little bit,
I just want to think about ways in which to get more people, you know, directly connected. Since you know, meeting in larger numbers gets complicated, right now.
Well, we're having one on July 18. It's on imperialism in the 21st century. How it's changed and how international solidarity has to adjust to the new situation. And we're co-sponsoring it with a group called Liberation Road. And I expect more than 100 people will take part in. So we'll have a way to set it up so to handle that kind of thing using Zoom. And we'll also have some side sessions, rooms and spaces available for people to talk in.
Yeah, that's why I chose Zoom over.
So you might want to put July 18 on your calendar.
Okay, well, I will too, Carl.
I just did.
Okay, absolutely.
John,
yeah.
Are you good?
I'm good.
Are we ready to close it out?
Yes, I am. Please, Mike, take us out, please. Okay.
Okay.
Or Bernie.
On behalf of our friends Carl, Tina, and Randy, I thank the original dusty-footed philosopher and host, Mr. John Case, for hosting Talking Socialism, and his sidekick, J.B. Christensen. Me, I'm the loudmouth guy, Mike Cucarini. We thank you so much for joining us. And next time, we're going to get some respect. I'll tell you.
Okay, buddy. Bye-bye, everybody. Thank you so much.
All right. All right.